Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Inside. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. What's that time of year when Governor Gavin Newsom is signing a slew of bills into law, or vetoing? Just days ago, that also includes a climate bill with the goal of tackling just a spectrum of projects, including curbing what is becoming a seamless season of destructive and deadly wildfires. A new state workforce will soon handle wildfire prevention in California, allowing CAL FIRE to focus more on firefighting. As it stands, CAL FIRE has been largely responsible for forest thinning, prescribed burns, and encouraging home hardening, as well as fighting fires. But as fire season continues to become more of a year-round occurrence, fire prevention efforts have taken a back seat, as much of CAL FIRE's workforce has focused on battling wildfires. The legislation Governor Gavin Newsom signed into law late last week could allow for more fire prevention work to happen at the same time as firefights. So here to help us understand the new law is Cap Radio state government reporter Scott Rodd. Welcome, Scott.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, Scott, you've been covering wildfires and even investigated fire prevention numbers. How does this new law help meet the goals that Governor Newsom sets in terms of fire prevention?
Well, as you mentioned at the top, CAL FIRE has this double responsibility of having to both fight fires, but also do the work meant to prevent or mitigate them. And as the fire season gets longer, it just becomes more challenging to do that kind of prevention work, especially the type of work like prescribed burns, which really require favorable conditions where you don't want a controlled fire to get out of control and start a destructive wildfire. And so as these crews are being pulled onto responding to these massive blazes that we've seen in recent years, it just means less time to do this prevention work. And experts just say that can't be the answer. You know, we have to have a workforce that focuses on doing this kind of prevention work, forest thinning, forest management, and prescribed burns.
Given that when it comes to public land, a majority is actually managed federally by the U.S. Forest Service, for example. So why was it largely CAL FIRE's responsibility to handle fire prevention?
So we'll say that the U.S. Forest is also responsible. U.S. Forest Service is also responsible for handling fire prevention on their land, and they own they are responsible for a lot of land in California. So CAL FIRE, they've been, frankly, both agencies have a challenge with this, and this is the approach that CAL FIRE has decided to take, and it really is a departure from how agencies in the U.S. have handled firefighting and approached firefighting for the last century. It's largely been a prioritization of suppressing fires, of responding to fires, as opposed to prioritizing this prevention work. And we're really seeing a shift in mentality in terms of how we can try to curb this wildfire crisis. And more experts are saying we can't firefight our way out of this. We have to do the work ahead of time that will help mitigate and prevent the fires.
Well, given that we've just been increasingly having these conversations surrounding fire suppression and the consequences of fire suppression for really, as you were saying, the last century, and one of the contributors of why we've been experiencing and seeing so many large wildfires, can you just help remind us and elaborate on those conversations that are taking place?
Absolutely. You know, not to give too much of a history lesson, but for the last century, the approach has been responding to fires by suppressing them. And the belief was that if you fought hard enough, if you threw enough crew members at it, and if you, you know, had the right technology, you could beat back these fires. And for a while, that did work. We were able to suppress these fires quite well. The problem is that over time, vegetation became overgrown in our forests. And, you know, fire is a natural phenomenon in nature. And what it does is clear out a lot of that underbrush, and usually in a very sort of moderate or low intensity form. The problem now is that we're seeing these fires that are burning extremely intensely. And that's because this vegetation has grown over time. And so experts like Scott Stevens from UC Berkeley says that using things like controlled burning and forest thinning can really help create kind of a virtuous cycle. And here's what he had to say about prescribed burning, especially, which will be a really useful tool.
Many times you're after maybe burning the surface fuel to deaden down woody material, the small shrubs and grass. And you're also trying to reduce the density of some of the small trees because it can provide vertical continuity of the fuel from the ground up into the canopy. So when you burn those ladder fuels, burn up some surface fuel, certainly some of those dead trees will eventually fall on the ground. 8 to 10 years, you got to burn again. But you can get to a point where your understory fuel is relatively low. And then subsequently fire behavior when it gets into those systems will be moderate. Most prescribed fires, almost any fuel treatment, will never really stop a fire completely, but you're going to change fire behavior.
And that's what this is really about, is trying to achieve this sort of reset where we can reintroduce forest management and reintroduce controlled fire back into nature, where it creates this sort of virtuous cycle where it does what fire is supposed to do without burning out of control, without being destructive. And that's why this workforce is so essential, because in order to do that, in order to do this type of work, there really needs to be a year-round workforce that focuses on this. It can't be split between sometimes doing prevention, but then for a lot of the year focusing on suppression.
Yeah, it's a reset, but it's also kind of making up for the fire suppression that we've done for pretty much the last century. So when it comes to the new workforce from this law, what will be its main priority?
Its main priority will definitely be jump-starting that cycle. I mean, there's just so much catch-up work to do. Experts say there are millions and millions of acres of forest land in California, both state-owned land, private land, and then federal land certainly as well, that needs this sort of treatment. And it's not a one-time thing. As you heard Scott Stevens say, you know, this is something that has to be repeated. And so that's also part of the challenge. It's not like we can check a few boxes, and then once we address forest management on the acres that need it, we can pack it up and say, you know, job done. We have to repeat this work sometimes every 5-10 years. And so that's going to be the main focus, is figuring out how can we staff up, how can we get enough crew members to do this kind of prevention work and keep it going for the long term.
What have environmental experts said about this?
There is still some controversy about prescribed burning. There's just, you know, I think more and more people, experts, including environmentalists and conservation groups, have started to come around to it more and embraced the benefits of it. There are still questions about ensuring that it's done safely, ensuring that prescribed burning especially is done in such a way that it doesn't create excess smoke or unneeded, air quality issues, and also ensuring that it's still done in a way that isn't damaging natural habitats. And that's absolutely a focus of fire experts, fire scientists, and certainly this workforce. And again, it's about reintroducing forest management, reintroducing fire into these habitats in a way that is safe and, again, mirrors the way that fire naturally is present in these forests.
Given that this was just signed into law, what does the timeline look like when this new workforce can actually begin to work on fire prevention?
You know, that's a really good question. I think hiring will absolutely be a challenge. I mean, some of this work is fairly specialized. Some of the stuff that may be more manual labor, perhaps they can hire up those positions more quickly. But anytime you're staffing up a new state bureaucracy, and this is creating a new branch of state government, it's sort of consolidating some things that were already in existence, but that takes time. And that, you know, it'll take some money. There's at least $50 million set aside to help stand up this branch. So it still remains to be seen, you know, when this workforce will be fully up and running. But certainly the demand is there, and the expectation is that the sooner that the state is able to stand up this workforce, the sooner it's able to get onto this prevention work, which is desperately needed.
And I guess, how will this just affect CAL FIRE going forward? Will this new workforce work under the same umbrella as CAL FIRE or be separate?
So it will work under the state fire marshal. And so that's sort of like adjacent to CAL FIRE. Certainly, they will be working in very close coordination with this workforce. You know, CAL FIRE has a tremendous amount of institutional knowledge about where there have already been fires on the landscape, where prevention work has been done or has been planned. CAL FIRE also has very close relationships with different groups that have received grants from the state to do this kind of work. And so they'll certainly be working still very closely with CAL FIRE. But again, the idea is to try to relieve CAL FIRE of some of these responsibilities so that you can have that workforce that focuses mainly on suppression. I'm sure CAL FIRE will still be involved in some prevention work, but then also have another workforce that is primarily focused on prevention work. And so it is worth noting, though, that this new workforce, if needed, they can respond to fire suppression if it's absolutely needed. But in state statute, it says that they would be towards the lowest sort of priority in terms of calling up crews to respond. They really want to reserve this workforce to do mitigation work.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with CAP Radio state government reporter Scott Rodd. Before we let you go, late last week, also, PG&E was charged with manslaughter, among other crimes, for the 2020 Zog fire that's just outside Reading. I want to listen to some of what the CEO of PG&E said about the upcoming trial.
This was a tragedy. Four people died. And my coworkers are working so hard to prevent fires and the catastrophic losses that come with them. They have dedicated their careers to it. Criminalizing their judgment is not right. Failing to prevent this fire is not a crime.
And that is CEO Patty Pope. And she went on to describe the ways that PG&E has worked towards wildfire prevention, saying that this year PG&E is investing $1.4 billion in vegetation management, working on removing trees and burying power lines, among other things. And she ended by saying this.
We're putting everything we've got into preventing wildfires and reducing the risk. Though it may feel satisfying for the company of PG&E to be charged with a crime. What I know is the company of PG&E is people. 40,000 people who get up every day to make it safe and to end catastrophic wildfire tragedies like this. Let's be clear. My coworkers are not criminals. We welcome our day in court so people can learn just that.
Scott, as you know, this isn't the first time they have been charged with manslaughter. And during the campfire, they pled guilty to manslaughter charges. So remind us what happened during the 2020 Zog fire and why PG&E is being blamed for it.
So the 2020 Zog fire occurred in Shasta County, as well as in parts of Tehama County. It burned close to 60,000 acres. As you mentioned before, there were four deaths as a result of the fire, and hundreds of buildings were destroyed. So it really had a big impact on that community. And PG&E was blamed for it because there were trees that had contact with their transmission lines, and that's what started the fire, which has been the cause of a number of other fires as well, as you mentioned.
Yeah, and ultimately, what does this mean for the beleaguered utility company? I mean, PG&E is making promises and to change in recent years after causing the 2018 campfire, but ultimately, what does this mean for the fate of really this utility giant?
So again, this is another chapter in a very long saga of PG&E and wildfires. And, you know, the company has, as the CEO stated in that clip, they've made commitments to improve their power lines, their equipment, but also to trim trees and ensure that their lines are safe and free from hazards. But the state is overseeing it, and they've slapped the company on the wrist a few times, including earlier this year. They found that the company had not prioritized the highest risk lines in terms of removing trees. So they actually stepped up their oversight of the company, and they're on this sort of enhanced oversight is what it's called, that if the company continues to not meet the requirements of the state, ultimately, their license as a utility could be pulled. We're a ways off from that, but they're on this sort of path where that is an option if these failures continue to happen. I thought it was interesting hearing the CEO of PG&E sort of stake out that position of being very firm and claiming that, you know, they did not create, they did not cause any sort of criminal, they didn't commit any criminal activity or behavior. You know, as you said before, they had pled guilty previously to manslaughter charges. So they, it feels like they're really staking out this position of not wanting to budge from arguing their innocence. So it will be interesting to see what happens in court in this situation. But, you know, again, this is another chapter, and we're seeing potentially other chapters unfold this year during wildfire season. The Dixie Fire is just another example of, it appears as though the PG&E transmission lines may have been the cause of that fire as well. So this isn't very much an ongoing unfolding story.
Scott, we appreciate you following this.
I appreciate you having me on.
And that is CAP Radio state government reporter Scott Rahn. Up next, winter was the deadliest season for Sacramento homeless residents. We'll explore if the death toll is prompting changes ahead of colder temperatures. Also, we'll head to the Eastern Sierra and explore the invaluable yet historically underappreciated ways indigenous communities measure and document climate change. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. 137 homeless people died on the streets, in hospitals or vehicles across Sacramento County last year. That's according to an annual report on homeless deaths, and it was published last week by the Sacramento Regional Coalition to End Homelessness. At the same time the report was released, Sacramento opened its newest homeless shelter, the X Street Navigation Center, under the WX Freeway near Oak Park. CAP Radio's Chris Nichols covers homelessness and joins us this morning to discuss all of this. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Vicki.
Chris, we know that for people experiencing homelessness, you know, they face a range of challenges, not the least of which is their physical safety and well-being. What are some of the key takeaways from this report?
There are a lot of takeaways from the report. For example, that 137 number, that's one less than the previous year, 2019. But as we talk about this, of course, I think it's important to remember that each death tallied in this document is a human being, somebody's son, someone's daughter, maybe a brother or a sister, or perhaps even someone's parent. And there's sadness tied to all of these deaths. I spoke with Bob Erlenbush of the Regional Coalition to End Homelessness. That's the group that publishes the report, which is based on data they receive from the Sacramento County Coroner's Office. And he told me the number of deaths due to hypothermia was higher than in past years. There were 4 confirmed hypothermia deaths and 2 suspected ones. And Erlenbush said that he typically sees deaths spread out evenly among the seasons each year, but that was not the case in 2020.
Winter was the deadliest season. 35% of the deaths occurred in winter. That's 10% higher than in past reports.
Well, based on that larger number of people passing away in winter, what's Erlenbush and others recommending?
He and Faye Wilson Kennedy, who is co-chair of the Sacramento Poor People's Campaign, they both told me that they want to see city officials find and open warming centers earlier this year. Warming centers are those temporary shelters that in the past have opened for maybe a night or two around the city, but only during the coldest stretches of winter. And advocates like Erlenbush and Kennedy say that opening them earlier could prevent some people from freezing on the streets. They also say that these centers should be placed near homeless camps, not miles away where they won't be used.
Right, because one of the main arguments and problems when it comes to this issue is that people don't use these centers or don't even know about them.
Right, I think the problem is both of those things. CAP Radio photographer Andrew Nixon and I visited some of the cooling centers that opened during our really intense heat waves this summer. But we found only a small number of people using them or even that they knew about them. And so it's a problem that both advocates and city leaders are trying to solve.
Chris, you spoke with Sacramento Mayor Daryl Steinberg about this report. Let's hear his reaction to it.
The report itself is always shattering to know that people die and in large numbers out on the streets. I mean, it continues to be the primary reason why we all must be motivated, and I am certainly motivated as the mayor, to make this better.
Yeah, and the mayor, I mean, when it comes to the issue surrounding homelessness, it is one of his largest priorities since he became mayor of Sacramento. And he, as he said, he's motivated to make this better. So what is the mayor and the rest of the city doing, especially when it comes to the issue of warming centers during the winter, which is fast approaching?
Well, Steinberg noted that the city council back in March, they voted to eliminate some rules that they said limited when the city could open these warming and cooling centers, what they like to call respite centers. In the past, if you had, you could only open them essentially when you had three consecutive nights of freezing temperatures. They no longer follow that criteria after that vote back in March. And the mayor at recent council meetings has urged city officials to start working on this issue earlier than in past years and to use not just the same public libraries and community centers as in the past, but some of which are, you know, kind of far away from these homeless camps, but to find private property owners closer by who might be willing to open their doors to help out.
We are at the very beginning of fall. And now we must engage the private sector, all governmental jurisdictions, to find respite centers so that when winter comes, we are ready and we have more places for people to come indoors.
Well, speaking of indoors, Sacramento opened a new homeless navigation shelter near Oak Park last week. It's called the X Street Navigation Center. And Chris, you took a tour of the shelter, so tell us about it.
It's located on X Street, just west of Alhambra Boulevard and right next to the WX Freeway. And there are several homeless encampments within about a quarter mile of the shelter. And when you walk inside, you can see it has dorm style beds for up to about 100 people. The beds are inside this large tan tent-like structure, which is built by a company called Sprung Instant Structures, and they make prefabricated buildings using tension fabric supported by a metal frame. There is a separate building that serves as a dining hall and as a kitchen.
And this center isn't simply just providing food and an indoor space, but the X Street Center will also offer other resources, correct?
That is right. It also offers medical care. It offers financial counseling. And importantly, it offers housing placement services. Critics have in some cases said that, you know, shelters simply warehouse people, but Sacramento's goal with this shelter is to connect people with either transitional or permanent housing within 6 months of their arrival.
The city says that the shelter is going to be a low barrier shelter. Can you just explain to us what that means and why it's significant?
Well, that means that people can bring their pets, they can bring their partners, their possessions when they move in. People do not need to be sober to live there. They cannot drink or use drugs on the property or bring weapons. But in the past, shelters have had strict rules on these things, and not being able to bring a pet or possessions was a deal breaker. Many people would choose to remain outside on the streets rather than give those things up. And Joe Smith, the advocacy director at Loaves and Fishes in Sacramento, Homeless Services Center, he talked about the importance of the X Street shelter having these lower barriers.
It's great because part of trust in a situation, you know, when you're thinking about living outside or going indoors, is, well, am I going to have to give up everything I own? Because what if I do have to go back out on the street? And that's been people's experiences through the years. They go into a variety of different shelter situations or even living in another person's house, and then everything falls apart and they got to leave. So if they give up everything they own, they're in a worse spot than they were to start with.
You know, Chris, as you mentioned, that there are several encampments and tents just nearby this navigation center, and I actually have been out there and reported on it as it was being built. Were you actually able to talk to some of the people who live nearby who are experiencing homelessness and are unhoused and just kind of gauged how they're feeling about the center?
I did, and several of them told me that, at least for the most part, they're interested in the shelter. But there are still things that hold some of them back from making that move. For example, I spoke with Marcy Pompey. She's 60 years old and was born and raised in Sacramento. She lives in a tent less than a block from the shelter, and she's been homeless for about 3 years. And like a lot of people who are unhoused, she has pets. She owns 2 dogs. She's taking care of 3 others, but the shelter only allows people to bring 1 pet. And Pompey told me that's a big problem for her.
The shelter, I think, is really wonderful. They're really good at helping people get into places. Pet thing is just like, this is the only one I know that only allows 1. Other places have more. I mean, motels.
You have to make a tough decision.
Well, there is no decision. I can't go. I will not. This is a family. I mean,
you know, when you actually spoke with the shelter, were they aware of Marcy Pompey, given that she lives less than a block from the center?
They are. They're aware of her. They're aware of quite a few people nearby. The shelter's chief operating officer, Amani Sawirs, told me that staff have spoken with Pompey. They're trying to work on an arrangement where she can be at the shelter.
Yeah, Chris, you also spoke with 59-year-old Michael Belton, who grew up in Oak Park. What did he say about the shelter?
Well, Belton told me he's been homeless for about 6 weeks. He lives under the freeway right across the street from the shelter, and he was pretty optimistic and eager to move in.
If you don't have any place to go, it would be better to be in the shelter than be out in the cold. I mean, I would.
Have you talked to anybody over there?
I went and they had a meeting over there and they were telling them how the place is going to be. And it's going to be more like a neighborly place for people in the neighborhood to run it. They want everybody to be welcome.
And just like the few days since you got a tour of the shelter, I mean, this was just over the weekend. Were you able to get an update on the 2 residents that you were chatting with?
I did. I got an update over the weekend from the shelter, and they told me that Michael Belton, who we just heard from, he has entered the shelter. He now lives there. And they also told me that Marcy Pompey, she took a tour, but she's still thinking about it. They told me their staff hopes to continue building a relationship with her so that she can feel safe and comfortable there.
Well, that's good to hear. Finally, Chris, what else should people know about the X Street Shelter before we let you go?
It's part of Sacramento's comprehensive homeless siting plan, and that's the effort to establish shelters and tiny homes and sanctioned camping sites all across the city. There are community and legal concerns about that plan and about the X Street Shelter. Our colleague, CAP Radio news reporter Janelle Salonga, did some additional reporting on those topics. You can find all of that online at capradio.org.
And we also have Janelle's reporting on our Insight page. Thanks so much, Chris.
Thank you, Vicki.
And that is CAP Radio reporter Chris Nichols. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. Well, climate change is one of the most pressing issues here in California, and we all experience the effects from increasing heat waves, closer periods of drought, wildfires, rising ocean waters. I mean, I could go on and on. The state isn't only responding to the effects of climate change, however, but also studying the details of its impacts. However, historically left out of that scientific research are the invaluable yet underappreciated ways indigenous communities across the state experience climate change. That is now changing. We're going to head down Highway 395 to the Eastern Sierra and learn about a new partnership in tracking climate change. Joining us now is CAP Radio environment reporter Manola Sakaida. Manola, welcome to Insight.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What sparked your interest in this topic and really led your reporting down to the Eastern Sierra?
Yeah, so in recent years, I think that we've already seen as a state how Indigenous knowledge can guide or impact our responses to climate change and disastrous natural events like, you know, wildfires, for instance. So we've seen that in just the way that we've been putting an emphasis on using prescribed burns to reduce excessive fuel loads in the forests, which is something that tribes throughout the state have done for thousands of years. And I see that state agencies are recognizing that more and more often. So, you know, in light of that progress, I was interested in learning how tribes have become part of other responses the state has, you know, to natural disasters and elements of climate change. And then I learned about this report, which happened to include the voices of some tribal members in the Eastern Sierra.
Your reporting includes the Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment, that's OEHHA. I don't know if that's familiar to a lot of people. So can you just explain what role they play in researching climate change in California?
Yeah, definitely. So the office, you know, also known as OEHA is how they pronounce it. That's the state's agency that looks at health risks posed by environmental contaminants. So basically assessing health risks from contaminants in the air and the soil, water, et cetera. But also, you know, for around the past 10 years, they've started doing this monitoring of what they call indicators of climate change, which basically means tracking trends in various aspects related to climate change, which can mean, you know, drought, dryness, wildfires, a lot of those details of just how climate change manifests.
Yeah, and I guess what we're learning about really is just essentially bridging a gap in something that's been missing. So what led the state agency to identify this need?
Yeah, it's kind of simple in how it came up, and then it became this more, you know, complex thing. But basically, when I talked to OEHA about this process, I learned that in an early conversation for this most recent report, which began back in 2019, and the report's going to be published in just a couple months now. Basically, they noticed that they'd never really included anything about the impacts of climate change on tribes. So, you know, starting from that, they realized that there was a gap there. And some members of the department wondered if tribes have their own relationships to climate change, which ended up being, you know, more than true. And it also ended up teaching a lot of members of this department a lot about what it means to work with tribes and, you know, work for tribes, rather than work in a way that excludes their voices.
So given that this is a new partnership, what did they do differently with this recent report? I believe it's going to be published in December, so just in a couple months.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. So basically, OEHA reached out to Native communities throughout the state for this report. And, you know, this is the first time, like I said, that they've gone and done that. And they managed to include, I think, yeah, voices representing 30 tribes in the state. And then some tribes even, you know, reported out pieces of the report themselves, so they have their own sections in the report. So I talked to Lori Montserrat, who's a senior environmental scientist with OEHA, who led these tribal outreach efforts, and she explained to me why this was so important. So basically, while Western researchers have been studying climate change in the environment of California for a little while now, I think Lori said around, you know, 100 years, she told me that's only a blip when compared to how long Native people have been, you know, on this land and living on this land. So she told me that tribes basically have the deepest historic knowledge of this land, and that should matter to researchers.
The tribes have knowledge. The tribes have the deepest knowledge. They have the stories. They have the wisdom. And yes, those two, all of that knowledge can work together. But I don't think that traditional Western science, you know, looking at data from the past 100 years, for example, mm-hmm. stands as strong without mm-hmm. that perspective, without that deep tribal perspective.
Yeah, and when you're talking about Lori Montserrat, and you mentioned she's an environmental scientist, but you also had this fascinating conversation with her where she's learning from these indigenous tribes in the Eastern Sierra when it comes to the drought. I mean, can you share what she learned from them?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, when I talked to her, she went on and on about how this has been, you know, a huge learning experience for her, too. And just, you know, how shocked she was just by the fact that, you know, she's been missing out on a lot by not hearing these voices in the past. So she told me about this early conversation she had. It was during an early listening session with a group of Eastern Sierra tribes. And among them was a member of the Colville Paiute tribe, Gracie Dick. And Gracie told her, and this was back in 2019, this conversation that, anyways, Gracie told her that she expected a drought to be coming up. And Lori was, you know, a little bit confused by this. She hadn't really heard much about any drought at that time. And she responded by asking her a bunch of questions about indicators of drought that she would have been checking, you know, before making this statement. And Gracie told her that she could tell because she'd noticed a drop in the production of oak acorns, which some tribes in California annually harvest. So they have, you know, a relationship with the growth of acorns. And Lori says she didn't think anything of it at the time. She actually thought in her head, like, huh, what does this woman know, is what Lori told me. And now, obviously, we're dealing with drought, and it turned out that Gracie was right. So that, for Lori, was just a moment that she shared with me that really impacted her, and was a moment where she kind of had to pause and think, wow, there's a lot that I am not aware of simply because, you know, I don't have this relationship with my environment.
Right. And it's a humbling moment, and just kind of becoming aware of your own blind spots, even as a scientist. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm just curious, why is Indigenous knowledge frequently left behind in research about climate change?
So, you know, Indigenous knowledge often is passed down through oral tradition, so word of mouth. And obviously, this is a very broad term, but basically, this knowledge can include everything from, you know, stories or cultural activities like basket weaving, or knowledge about areas on ancestral lands where tribal members might typically harvest a certain thing, you know, things like that. It's really, really a wide variety of things. And when I was talking to Lo Stewart, who's the tribal chairperson for the Big Pine Paiute tribe of the Owens Valley, she told me that, you know, this is a reason why Western science tends to devalue it.
When it comes to how the government and Western groups collect knowledge, they have a tendency to specifically only reference prior words that have been written down.
So Stewart told me that this reliance on written documentation has led to Indigenous perspectives being left out, you know, being left behind, or even not believed by Western academics. This approach doesn't make sense, especially when researchers are studying areas where Native communities have the expertise.
That's one of the big reasons why I struggle to make sure the tribe gets to create its own narrative, because I can't look at a family photo of, like, you, for instance, and be able to tell everybody as an expert, you know, who you are and who your family is.
Well, given that Indigenous communities have long experienced the effects of climate change, have any tribes began tracking these impacts beyond oral tradition?
Definitely. And, you know, in talking to OEHA, the researchers that worked on this report noted that a lot of the tribes they reached out to already were documenting this in some way on their own. Among one of them, one of the tribes that contributed to this OEHA report was the Palo Band of Mission Indians, who run the Tribal Climate Health Project. And that tracks data around the health impacts from climate change on tribes so that tribes can better respond to them. So, you know, that's one example of how tribes have been working on that. And then, you know, we also see tribes like the Creek tribe in the north focusing on educating others about the impacts of good fire, prescribed fire, educating people on why they're so important and how forests have negatively, you know, changed without that. So sharing that knowledge that they've accrued for thousands of years. So yeah, a lot of tribes have been working on that, and not just for themselves, but also, you know, sharing that knowledge out with others.
You know, we've actually had the Karuk tribe on about the impacts of good fire and partnering with the state. And it was just a fascinating interview. How will this change the framework of future reports on climate change, since this is a new partnership?
So, yeah, like I mentioned, what's really cool about this process is that OEHA researchers learned about indicators of climate change that they would otherwise have not known about. So, you know, like I mentioned before, some tribes, for example, noted differences in the foods that they traditionally harvest, like reporting fewer acorns to harvest that have been used for a really long time for cultural dishes, or even reporting a difference in their taste and, you know, how the environment that's changing around them could contribute to that. So these are all indicators that OEHA had never tracked to this extent before. And Lori, that OEHA researcher I talked to, told me that it's something they can build on in future reports. And, you know, that's something that other researchers can learn, too, that tribal perspectives often include data points that they might miss entirely.
Right. Finally, I'm just curious, what surprised you most during your reporting?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's already known that we miss a lot when we don't include Indigenous perspectives in science. But working on this story, that just really hit me, you know, again and again, all that we've missed. And just seeing that everywhere in this report, I'm really excited for, you know, people that are interested in this to have a look once it's published. And yeah, just honestly, just realizing that this is just scratching the surface, that there's so much more we can learn from Native communities when it comes to climate change.
Yep, absolutely. Thanks for sharing your reporting, Manola.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And that is CAP Radio environment reporter Manola Sakaida. Still ahead, if you don't know Scott Lay by name, you may have known his work. We remember a beloved political insider whose passing is sending shockwaves both inside and outside the state capitol. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment. Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. It's been about a week since news broke of the passing of a Sacramento political insider that really sent shock and heartache to those who knew him inside and outside of the state capitol. Scott Lay passed away earlier this month. He was 48 years old. Most people who do business at the Capitol knew him or knew of him, politicians, their staff, lobbyists. Scott was a regular fixture at the Capitol, often seen in the hallways, in committee sessions, offices, the elevators, stairwells, and yes, the cafeteria as well. If you don't know who Scott Lay was, you may have known his work as a publisher of The Nooner. That was a lunchtime newsletter of state politics and legislation. Joining us to remember Scott are two of his friends and colleagues, Paul Mitchell, who is vice president of Political Data, Inc., and Anthony York. Anthony is a former editor at Capital Weekly. Thank you both for joining us, and we just really extend our condolences to all of you who knew Scott Lay.
Thanks. It's a long list of people around the Capitol and the country that knew Scott.
Indeed it is. And in such a beautiful way, like the Twitter feed was just, you know, was really focused on Scott, and it was obviously well deserved. Paul, just starting with you, can you encapsulate who Scott was, especially for those in our audience who may not have known him or his work?
Yeah, so Scott is, he grew up as a kid in Orange County. He was sick a lot. And struggled with asthma and became really close with a lot of the cystic fibrosis community out of high school. I met him in college. And when he got involved in politics and started working in that arena, it was the thing that really gave him kind of a focus and an energy outside of himself, helped him get healthier, helped him kind of have this real intense motivation. And it became his life. He did his first little email newsletter, called The Donkey's Mouth, when he was a college student at Orange Coast College. And there was a newspaper article written in 1994 about how he sends these letters to people's internet mailboxes, over 100 recipients at the time. Amazing. And that was back in the dial-up days. And he had a career that spanned a few decades working as the CEO of the California, the Community College League, an association of college trustees and presidents, but never lost that kind of focus on, you know, reaching out to thousands and then ultimately tens of thousands of people to talk about politics and policy. And in 2014 or so, he dedicated himself entirely to this this work. And his style of media coverage was different than, you know, like an actual published newspaper with an editor and all of the kind of journalistic elements to it. It had a little bit of politics. It had a lot of policy. It had insider stuff. It had gossip. And it really predated some of the things that you see now more from like Politico and other, you know, even different publications will have their like email news blast that goes out and tries to have a little personality. Well, Scott really proved to those folks that that was possible with the success of his Nooner and other ventures that he engaged in.
Well, Anthony, you had a working relationship with the Roundup and later the Nooner. I mean, how did you meet Scott, and what do you want the rest of us to remember about him?
So I met Scott when I first came to Sacramento as a journalist in 1997. And he was either, I believe he was in law school at that time. He had lobbied for the Community College League and was now just, of course, in his spare time lobbying for the UC Students Association and organizing, ways of students to come up to protest fee increases at the University of California at that time. And so I met Scott first as he was a source for me. I learned very quickly that he was super knowledgeable about arcane details of California state policy. I'm really wired into sort of the gossip insidery news circuit. And I think Scott really sort of encapsulated two simultaneous changes that were going on back in the late 90s. Number one, the term limits law in California was phasing in. And so a lot of newer, younger members were being elected and newer staff and lobbyists were coming to Sacramento with them. And then also the technological change that was afoot and that Scott was already dialed into. And he had a really unique combination of sort of an advocate's heart and spirit and a policy wonk's knowledge and then a journalist sensibility about getting that information out there and sharing it with others and was really committed to the mission of helping people understand more about state government. I think to this day, it's largely undercovered and it was, certainly was, back 25 years ago when Scott started up here and I think he committed himself to making sure people knew more about what was happening in Sacramento.
You know, in the last couple minutes we have, I just want to ask the both of you, what do you think his legacy will be at the Capitol and just overall in state politics? Paul?
Well, there are a few different legacies. He had this hyperkinetic energy that got him into both telling these stories via these newsletters and then also creating tools to allow people to have better access to government information, campaign finance, and bills and legislative tracking. By pushing that almost as a volunteer basis, he ended up getting agencies and bigger organizations to actually catch up to what they should be providing to the public. And I think that's a longstanding legacy that he'll have, and he's definitely going to be missed.
Anthony?
Yeah, and that he was a fierce advocate, right? And all of his public work stemmed from a true passion for a number of issues, whether it was expanding access to education, higher education for others, or sharing public information, ensuring it was transparent. And I think his true legacy is really one of what you can do in your spare time. You don't have to be pigeonholed and be any one thing, but you can be productive and prolific in a way that really does touch others and change the way that people, change the relationship people have with the government.
Yeah, well, it's clear that his legacy will definitely be felt not only at the state capitol, but just throughout the state. Thank you both so much for joining us to share about your friend and your colleague, Scott Lay.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
And that is Paul Mitchell and Anthony York. If you actually like to read Anthony's article in the Capitol Weekly about Scott Lay, we have it posted on our Insight page at capradio.org, and it is a wonderful article. Well, that is it for Insight today. You can learn more about all of our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Thank you to producer Cynthia Lopez and managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, and Megan Venata. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer is Chris Feltz. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. And I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.